Daniel chapter 8, did I say that already? What is the biggest barrier to understanding the Bible properly? Just think about that for a moment. A lot of misunderstandings about the Bible. A lot of different reasons that people misunderstand. What is the biggest barrier? Now, there's several barriers. One is language, right? Language, if you don't understand the language, it's hard to understand. That's mostly been solved by the printing press. Now the Bible exists in your, and you have many in your language if you want to pick whatever translation you want. But even in other languages, for the most part, the Bible's been translated into most languages. Not all, but most. Culture is a barrier. We don't do things the same way that they did things in the times that it was written. And this is a problem that's only going to get worse as history progresses. As we get further and further from the text, we lose some of the cultural elements or the idioms, perhaps the language, some of the specific language unique to the culture of the time. So that's one barrier. Preconceptions. I'm going to lump these next two in together. Preconceptions and incorrect information. These sort of go hand in hand, right? We have preconceptions about the Bible, and we think it says one thing, but we really don't know. But because of our preconceptions about Scripture or our preconceptions about miracles, this is a big one, right? Is if you assume automatically that miracles can't exist, well, that's going to be a barrier to understanding what the text says because the text contains miracles. So preconceptions, incorrect information, if you assume certain things about the church based on bad experiences you've had in the past, and people have treated you poorly in the church, well, when you read the Bible, it's going to be a barrier to understanding. As you think about these different things, I think there is something that is more profound than any of these. And it is profound because it affects each of these, and that is time. Time is the thing that makes understanding the Bible properly difficult. Specifically, our displacement in time from the original audience. You know, I don't really have much in common with a 6th century B.C. Jew, or a 5th century B.C. Jew, a Jew who lived at the time 5 centuries before Christ, living in Babylon in captivity. I don't have a lot of framework to understand his or her mind. Now, I do have the basic framework of humanity to understand. But you think about the cultural differences, the differences in time, and we could apply that to any section of Scripture. You think about the differences in time pre-flood, before the flood, and now. I imagine the world was much different before the flood than it is today. And part of our understanding of the early chapters of Genesis, our ability to understand and comprehend some of the chapters and some of the things that are discussed very early in Genesis, are because so much time has passed and the world is not the same as it was then. Time is the thing that makes understanding Scripture difficult. And this is mostly because people tend to make everything about them. Talked about this a lot in the Revelation class, but the same applies to the book of Daniel. Readers of every age tend to assume that the Bible is talking about them. And the further you go in time from the original audience, especially in some key texts like Daniel and Revelation, the further you go in time from that original writing, the less it talks about you. So our default assumption to make everything about us, that the Scriptures must be talking directly to me, as we advance in time from the original point of authorship, it becomes more and more difficult to really understand what the text is saying. Daniel 8 through 12, this is the last stretch of the book of Daniel, and it switches, interestingly, original languages from, it switches back to Aramaic. It was... Now, I can't remember what the other one was. The first 7 chapters were in the Babylonian language. I can't remember what the Babylonian language is now. It's escaped me. But Daniel chapter 8 through 12, the earliest manuscripts we have, switch back to Aramaic. And it is interesting, I think, as you look through the literary style of Daniel 8 through 12 versus the previous 7 chapters, it is different. Because I think Daniel is writing in his native tongue now, where he wasn't previously. And Daniel 8 through 12 does have several key themes as Daniel is given these, they're not visions, right? Some of them are visions, but really he's having a conversation with angels is what is going on in these last 8 chapters. He is seeing sort of visions, not dreams necessarily. And as he has this series of conversations with Gabriel predominantly, Michael at one point, some other figure we don't quite know about, there are several things that come up over and over. Number one is these angelic messengers. We're going to see Gabriel. He first appears here. Of course, Gabriel is famous most of all for his discussion with Mary in the beginning of the Gospels. Contrasted with what? Well, in the first seven chapters of Daniel, how did he receive his revelations from God? It wasn't through angelic messengers. It was from the dreams. Not only his own dreams, but the dreams of the kings around him. And in chapter 8, that switches. Not dream-based anymore, but these conversations with these heavenly beings. We see another theme is the offering in the temple. 8:13 and 14, 9:24 through 27, 11:31 and 12:11 through 13, once in each chapter, once in each revelation, right? Because these are all different revelations that Daniel receives. There's this discussion of the offering and the temple. And this is particularly important because of the one time when Jesus himself quotes the book of Daniel in Matthew chapter 24. When Jesus quotes and says, "Thus when you see the abomination of desolations that's spoken of by Daniel the prophets." And that idea in Matthew 24 goes back to this theme in the latter four chapters of Daniel of the offering and the temple. Things that would take place specifically in Jerusalem, the seat of Israel worship. The seat of the offering system and the sacrificial system, the central point. And several of these earthly kings, as we'll see in 8 through 12, specifically go against and desecrate and desolate. The word that's used most often is desolate, the offering and the temple. And that's going to come up over and over again. We see, of course, as we have seen in the book of Daniel, and this is, in fact, the theme of Daniel more than anything else, right? The rise and fall of kings. But particularly in the last eight, or in the last four chapters, 8 through 12, that's actually five chapters. I've been saying four this whole time, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, five chapters. It's okay. As we see in these last five chapters, the particular emphasis is placed upon the way that these kings go against, and in several places it's used, go against the Prince of Princes, go against the Prince of the Host, go against the King of Kings, that they are elevating themselves specifically against God. So we get to chapter 8. And as we've said previously, Daniel 8 through 12, telescopes, zooms in on the visions in chapter 2 and 7. In chapter 2, we have the four pieces of the statue in Nebuchadnezzar's dream. In chapter 7, Daniel's given a vision of these four beasts. And these last five chapters zoom in on that. What happens specifically with those four beasts and those four statues? What happens with these four kingdoms is zoomed in upon and explained in 8 through 12. Daniel 8, 1 through 4. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel. He switches to first person here. After that which appeared to me at the first, I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. Now, why is this significant? He has transported in vision, I don't think he's actually teleported, but he's transported in vision to a different city. He's not in the capital city anymore, now he's back in Susa. And I saw in the vision, and it was at the Ulai Canal, I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns. Both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased, and he became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth, without even touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled upon him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. I don't think there's any other place in Scripture that uses the word conspicuous so often. I got a picture, pulled it off the internet, of an artist's rendition of this. And imagine you're Daniel. You're just in the capital city, and suddenly your vision is shifted. Now you're standing in a completely different city. You may never even, I doubt Daniel had ever been in Susa at this point. And now you're standing in this new place, this canal. Maybe you've seen it or heard references to it or seen descriptions of it. You're a learned man. You know where you are. And you see before you these weird animals. Well, not that weird, really. Pretty normal. Although the goat having the weird horn, unicorn goat. And they come against each other. And a lot of the artist renditions that I saw made the beasts supernaturally large, right? And perhaps they were in his vision. And they clash against each other, and there's not really an explanation given, right? The text, he just sees this vision, and what am I to make of that? As his vision would return to him, probably, as he's standing still in Babylon, and he would be confused. Wouldn't you be confused if you suddenly had this vision of these weird animals? Daniel 8, 9 through 12, one of them, let's go back and read this. The great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. The glorious land is significant. We'll get back to that. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of the sanctuary was overthrown. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression. And it will be thrown, and it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard the Holy One speaking, and another Holy One said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful states. Now, fortunately for Daniel and for us, he's just given an interpretation by the angel. And this is what I say, this is one of the weird things about these last five chapters, is we get to see a series of conversations between Daniel and an angel. Verse 15, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. Why would he understand it, right? There's nothing in the vision that would give him any frame of context to understand what he's seen. These four great beasts with the horns the four great horns that then become, one becomes greater than the others. I don't exactly know how he would have seen that. Was it actually a horn that just became a huge horn? I don't know. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, "Understand, O son of man, that this vision is for the time of the end." Now, what we're going to see as we get through the last five chapters of Daniel, the end, the phrase "the end" is used several times. And it's not all describing the same end. End can mean any number of things, right? We could have the end of today, we could have the end of this week, we could have the end of this month, we could have the end of the year. The end, it's not given in literal words what end is being described, but as we read through these five chapters, we see that the end is not always the same. In particular, in this case, the end of Babylon, or the end of the Medo-Persian Empire. Up until now, how has God communicated with Daniel? With dreams and visions. And it's interesting, he uses an intermediary here. Gabriel, make this man understand. And really, in the past, I think just some understanding was just given to him supernaturally. Nebuchadnezzar conveys the dream to him. I had this dream of this great statue. What does this mean, Daniel? And then Daniel, just the understanding floods into him. You kind of get the sense that he just automatically understands. But now he's using an intermediary. Why the switch? It's interesting. I'm not sure there's an answer to that, but it does highlight once again the significance, especially of Moses and Abraham, who did not have to deal with intermediaries, right? God just spoke to Moses and Abraham, different than even Daniel, one of the best of God's prophets. When he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face on the ground, but he touched me and made me stand up, and he said, "Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation," for it refers to the appointed time of the end. It's not the end of time, but what end is he talking about? "As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the great kings of Media and Persia, an empire that had combined. And the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king." Now, the first king is almost assuredly Alexander the Great, who incidentally was not actually the first king of Greece, but he was the first king of Greece to start expanding the empire. He was the king who decided to look beyond his borders, the borders of Greece, and expand and conquer and overcome all the nations that surrounded him. And you read commentary after commentary, it would be very shocking if you ever found one that did not think this was Alexander the Great's. But how would this have sounded to Daniel? And this is what I said in the beginning of the sermon. Time, the separation in time. We know that it's Alexander the Great, right? We know that. Why? Well, because we're looking at this all in hindsight. We've seen, we have the historical record. We have all the records of him and what he did. And this is going to make more sense as we get through the end of the book. But Daniel has no frame of context to understand that, right? And you look at the words that he says here, Media and Persia and Greece. I'm not even sure how familiar Daniel would have been with Greece. Greece is just a nation over doing its own thing over there. The Medo-Persian Empire had not conquered Greece, I don't think. And even if they had, it was so far from Daniel, where Daniel was stationed. How familiar would he have been with Greece? So we hear the word Greece, we read it in the text, and we automatically have all these things that in our minds about the nation of Greece, especially at that time period, things that Daniel would just not have had any idea about. How would this have sounded to Daniel's readers? Who are they? Because Daniel did not write the book to you, right? He didn't write the book to me. He wrote it predominantly for the exiles in Babylon, the Jewish exiles who had been taken by the Chaldeans, who would eventually soon be sent back to Israel. And this book was for their benefit to know, hey, these are the things that are going to happen in the next 400 or 500 years. These are the things that are going to take place for you and your children and your grandchildren. For Daniel's original readers, this is all future stuff. But for us looking back on it in hindsight, we got to have some more information that Daniel's readers wouldn't have had any concept of. Daniel wrote it not for our benefit to know what would happen, but for Israel's benefit to know what would happen in their future. For us, that reason doesn't exist. And really, the book of Daniel, the thing that we primarily get out of the book of Daniel is not what his original readers got. His original readers got a message of hope and a message of promise and a message of the future. We don't get any of that. We get confirmation of prophetic power. We get a confirmation that God has a plan. We get an understanding of how God works with kings in the world. Not the same things that Daniel's original readers would have understood. And so it's hard for us as we try to understand the biblical text to put ourselves in their shoes. For the original audience, what would this have meant? Daniel 8:22, as for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. Alexander died in, what did I say, Keith? Was it 323? I think it was 323. 323 BC, Alexander dies. And over the next 20 years, after Alexander's death, is a struggle of murder and betrayal and war. His four generals and a fifth guy, but his four of his primary generals, he dies, and now everybody wants a piece of his kingdom, right? Everybody wants a piece of it. And then there's a fifth guy, Ptolemy, who decides, it's not just his general should get stuff, I should get stuff too. And over the next 20 years, there's this series of assassinations and murders, and Ptolemy steals the body of Alexander and takes it back with him to Egypt. A whole bunch of weird stuff. Eventually, things settled out, and this is a map of things eventually, 20 years after the death of Alexander. We have it looks better up there than it does on my screen. We have Cassander, Lysimachus, Antigonus, and Seleucus, the four generals, and Ptolemy, who decided to carve out his own kingdom too. You see, interestingly, the red line. I don't know how. See, the color's not showing up very well on this. I don't know why it isn't. Anyway, Ptolemy, Antigonus is this area, Cassander over here. He kind of got left out a lot. He didn't really get very much. And then Seleucus gets a ton. But the red line, that's Alexander's kingdom. You can see that Alexander had much more than any four of his generals had. Those horns were tiny. That's why the text says that these horns were not anything near the great horn of the goat. They didn't matter as much. They were inferior to the first. You can see why that is. Now, the rest of the text, the four, five chapters following, are going to focus on Seleucus. And the I'm going to say these words wrong because they're tough. The Seleucids, the people that followed from one of these particular generals, Seleucid and then his descendants, the text in chapter 8 is going to focus predominantly on what they did in these, it's going to be really in the following 200 years after Alexander's death. Now, chapter 11 is going to describe the dealings between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and there's a marriage that happens between these two people. Well, I think it's the son of the Ptolemies marries the daughter of Seleucus, and then there's a betrayal, and they get divorced, and murder happens, and that's all chapter 11. But as we think about this map, and the reason I put this map up there, is what Daniel's describing in 8 through 12 is not some weird thing like Revelation, and it's all complicated and confusing. These are simply the lives of these people who are trying to vie over the empire that Alexander had conquered, and their dealings and what they did. We keep reading in Daniel 8:23, at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limits, the transgressors being who? Being these guys, when they've reached their limits. A king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. And he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are saints. By his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great without warning. He shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes. And he shall be broken, but not by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. There's a sense in which even the people in Israel were not going to understand, right? There's no way that Daniel or the people of Israel understand any of that at the time, which is what I think is meant by seal up the vision. This vision is not meant to be understood exactly. This vision is to give you a brief understanding, a sort of generalized understanding of what's to come, and to understand that, yes, I have power and I know what's going to happen, but even you, Daniel, and even the people that you write to will not understand. Antiochus 4, Antiochus 4, most commentators agree that he's the little horn that rises up at the latter end, a king of bold face who understands riddles. Most people think it's Antiochus 5, who, incidentally, let me put the map back up there, he came from the line of the Seleucids, and you notice this is 20 years after Alexander's death that the Seleucid Empire ends right here, which is not including then Israel. At the time, 20 years after Alexander's death, Antigonus is the one who controls Jerusalem. So what it's talking about in this section here, Antiochus V expands the Seleucid portion of the Greek Empire and eventually does even conquer the nation of Israel again. He takes it from whoever was owning it at the time. And when he, during his reign, incidentally, he imposed a ban on temple worship in Jerusalem. During his reign, he comes in and conquers the Israelites, and he didn't like their worship. He wanted to establish pagan worship. So he bans the Israelite worship in the temple, and in fact sets up his own kind of worship in the temple that he and his people can do in Jerusalem. And this is what's meant and this is important because of how people try to connect this to Revelation. When these texts talk about all of the different offerings and the desolations of the temple, and the different things, the abominations in the holy place, and the taking away and the removing of the offerings, what they are talking about and what Daniel's talking about is the way that earthly kings would impose their will upon Jerusalem. Four different kings who do that and what they do in Jerusalem. Why that's relevant is when Jesus comes along in Matthew 24 and he talks about the abomination that makes the abomination of desolations that Daniel speaks of, he again is talking about a destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. In that context, in Matthew 23 through 25, people want to apply that to the end times, but that's not what it's talking about. Matthew 23 through 25, like Daniel 8 through 12, is discussing what kings, earthly kings, do to the temple in Jerusalem and the removal of the sacrificial system and the corruption of what God had ordained in the book of Leviticus for the atonement offerings and the peace offerings. Not some future time from now. Now, you can make the period of 3 years fit with the numbers in Daniel 8, the 2300 mornings and evenings. If you take that as evenings and mornings combined is 2300, so we have, what is that? 1150 evenings and 1150 mornings. Well, if you say that, 1150 days works out to about 3 years. Maybe that's what that means, but my point in that is you can make the numbers fit anything if you try hard enough. I just did it in three steps. 2300 mornings and evenings, well, obviously that's talking about mornings and evenings separate, so I have to separate that number. It's not actually 2300, it's really 1150. And if I divide 1150 by 365, it's 3.15, so 3.15 years, which is roughly, but not exactly, the time that Antiochus imposed his ban in Jerusalem. But I can make the numbers work any way I want. And what I really try to stress in Daniel and Revelation is trying to make all the numbers fit into sort of a coherent pattern, that way lies madness. And you'll just end up going around and around and around in circles. Daniel 8, 11 through 14, it became great, even as great as the prince of the host. The regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of the sanctuary was overthrown, and a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression. Whose transgressions? And most of these kings, what is it? It's because Israel transgressed. And in the intertestamental period, indeed, Israel did transgress and wander away from God again. And so God allowed another king, this time Antiochus, to come in and destroy them. Daniel 8 through 12 contains a sequence of rulers who desolate the temple in Jerusalem, and this will ultimately end with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, shortly after the life of Christ. So we'll close this lesson with some practical application. And as I read these lessons, or I read through these chapters, one of the things I struggle with in a sermon on Daniel is trying to come up with different practical applications for each lesson. Because really, every chapter in Daniel says the same thing. Every chapter in Daniel is, this king's going to come do some stuff, elevate himself against God, persecute the people of God, and then he'll be destroyed. That's literally every chapter of Daniel, is one king comes and one king dies, and that's it. So you're trying to think about practical application in the book, and really the series, why we're going through the series is not so much the practical application as it is people wanted to know what the things meant. People wanted to know how it fit historically, so that's what we're doing, and that's fine. But as we go through a practical application of Daniel, we're going to keep seeing the same themes over and over. God is in control. We need to trust in God. He has power over the nations. But here's one I found out of this chapter particularly. And this is a point that I could have made any number of times, but I'm choosing to make it now because I need to vary things up. We should not expect any earthly government, including our own, I might add, to submit to God's will. What do we see in Daniel over and over? It doesn't matter which earthly king was in charge, they didn't honor God. And it didn't matter even if they started out good. They eventually went away. They eventually elevated themselves. Because power corrupts, doesn't it? It doesn't matter who's in charge and it doesn't matter what they're in charge of. Power will corrupt. All earthly powers eventually exalt themselves. So we shouldn't be surprised when earthly governments do not submit to God's will. That should not be shocking to us, and we should not be expecting it. Is it great when it happens? Yes. But that's by far the exception throughout history. And it's interesting, in this country, we happen to have 150 years where that happened way more than most governments. And that was a time of blessing. But now I think we're entering the norm again. We had a brief period of time that was the exception to the rule. And now perhaps we are entering back into what the rest of the world has faced for 6,000 years. Earthly governments that do not submit to God's will. And because all earthly powers eventually exalt themselves, therefore all earthly powers eventually fall. Yes, the United States will fall. I don't know when. It may not be soon. But I can guarantee you it will happen. Just like China and Russia and Korea. They'll all fall. And in 1,000 years, the landscape of the nations, if the earth exists in 1,000 years, it's going to be completely different. But what will be the same? God's kingdom will exist. There will be Christians who strive to do God's will, no matter what the government is, no matter who's in charge. That's the promise that God makes to his people, that you will endure because you have received the kingdom that cannot be shaken. It doesn't matter what any earthly government does, the kingdom that you possess will endure. And even though it doesn't make sense to us, God has the future in mind. We happen to have, through vast amounts of historical archaeological data, a pretty good understanding of Daniel 8 through 12, because we happen to live in a time after the things that happened in that book it describes. God's people, Daniel and the people that he wrote to, their understanding was maybe half as good as ours about the events that would happen and the historical events and when they would happen and what exactly took place. But don't we have the same sense of not, it's not doubt per se, we have the same lack of understanding as they did. It's just we don't understand what's going to happen in our future. And even though Israel probably didn't understand all the things that God had in store for the time period between Daniel and Christ, God had the plan fully mapped out, didn't he? That was the point of Daniel, is I've got this all mapped out. You may not get it, you may not understand it, but man, it's mapped. And I may not know what's going to happen with you at the USA and Russia and China and Korea and Zimbabwe. I may not know that, but I know that God has it mapped out. Nothing's going to surprise him. Nothing's going to happen that he hasn't anticipated. So when we say the kingdom will endure, how can I say that with such certainty? Because the one who established the kingdom already knew all the things that were going to happen. Nothing's going to happen where God's going to be like, oh, that was surprising. I didn't expect that. Now the kingdom's at threat. The kingdom is not under threat ever, because the one who has ordained the kingdom knew everything that was going to happen when he established it. All that changes is who individually is in it. And what you can change is, are you in it or not? You can't threaten its existence, and neither can any other earthly ruler. Even though it doesn't make sense, and even though we may not understand it, there is a plan. The last thing is this. I think one of the things we struggle with in biblical interpretation, one of the ways we really get it wrong, and I said this at the beginning of the lesson, one of the ways we really get it wrong is we assume that everything in the Bible is directly applicable to us, and it's just not. There are vast swaths of historical information that do not directly apply to you. Now, they do indirectly apply to you, and when I say indirectly, I mean you can glean from example. You can learn from what they did wrong and try not to do that. But Daniel was not written to you. And most of the things in Daniel, all that's over with, right? My understanding of that doesn't particularly matter in the sense that all those things happened 2,000 years ago. It's all over and done. The prophetic warnings, I don't need those prophetic warnings. Now, the indirect application, yes. These two previous points are indirect application of the book of Daniel. I can see the things that were written to the people of Israel, and I can indirectly apply some things and some principles behind it. Classic example of this I talked about with the teens, Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for future and hope to give you, I think I paraphrased that wrong, plans for something, you know what I'm saying. And we want to apply that to us, that God has good things in store for my future. But I don't know that. What about the person who is faithful and they get cancer and they die? Or the person whose child is killed? I want to read Jeremiah 29:11 and think it's written directly to me, but it's not. That was written to these people in exile in Babylon. They were in exile and God is telling them, look, I know you're in exile and things are tough, but I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to restore your kingdom. I'm going to bring you back into Israel. And I have plans for you that are good. To give you a future and a hope, but that promise, while yes, it indirectly applies to me as it applies to heaven, I don't have that promise that my life's going to be great, the good things are in store for my life. We all know Christians who have suffered horribly, and our misunderstanding of God's principle for pain and for his will comes because we want to make everything about us, and it's not. We need to understand the Bible in its appropriate context. One of the things we see in the book of Daniel, Israel was offered a second and a third and a fourth and fifth and sixth chances over and over to serve the Lord. They didn't take the first chance, so God sends them into Babylon. They didn't take the second chance, so God sends the Assyrians. They didn't take the third chance, so God sent Antiochus. How many chances has God given you to serve him? You've probably received, well, if you're here today, you've received second, third, fourth, and fifth chances to do what he wants. But I don't know that you're going to get another one. I don't know that I'm going to get another one. The encouragement and the invitation is to take advantage of the chances that you're given, because it could all end tomorrow. Have you accepted what Jesus has offered you?